11th of his plays that I've had the pleasure of directing, all of them at the Academy. And I think everybody who's been involved in each one of those productions over the years has had a really special experience struggling, wrestling with these fabulous texts that he gives us. And so that's really all I wish to say at the moment. We have here before you Liam Brennan, who co-directed Wounds to the Face with me, which again was a new experience for both of us, but one that I think we survive, and we look forward to repeating. And also Maria Neubauer and Michael E. Corry. I have to explain that after this is actually Ed Corry, but he's subject to the exigencies of joining Equity and has to change his name. So some of his colleagues find that amusing. And of course, interestingly, it is an issue of identity here that we're talking about, which is something that's at the heart of Wounds to the Face itself. So over to Mark.
Thanks, Hugh. Okay, well, my name is Mark Brown. I'm theatre critic of the Sunday Herald and Scottish critic of the Daily Telegraph. And I know many of the students here because I also do the occasional class here at the Academy. It's my tremendous privilege and pleasure to be chairing this symposium. And also, while I'm here, explain what this machine is. Want to welcome also listeners to theatrevoice.com who will be able to hear this online. So just to add to the introductions, I'll introduce people as they are. Howard, we already have had a fulsome introduction to. We have Maria Neubauer, who's playing the mother in the current production of Wounds to the Face, over to the left. Immediately beside her is Liam Brennan, who, as I'm sure everyone here knows, is a celebrated actor in Scotland and is co-director on Wounds to the Face. Hugh, I think most people know, as the head of acting here at the Academy, as he says, currently directing his 11th Barker play here. And we've just had an introduction to Michael E. Corry, or Ed, as we'll call him, who is playing Monsieur, among others, in the current production. So, yes, I mean, we've already heard what Maggie has to say, and I certainly second that Howard is among the most important playwrights in the English language, if not in world theatre. I think that's more and more accepted, if not necessarily in England, around the world. And the author of many, many plays, including Victory, Scenes from an Execution, The Defence of the Thousandth Year, and of course, Wounds to the Face. And also a poet who's had a number of collections published, including the Torkman Diaries, and also a theoretician, and I would suggest philosopher of theatre, with a number of books published, including Arguments for a Theatre, and Death, the One, and the Art of Theatre. And publisher Oberon has been good enough to supply some leaflets of various recent publications of Howard, so you can pick them up at the end as we finish. So before I invite people in the audience to ask their own questions, make their own points, I just have to start the conversation with a few questions to Howard. I mean, as I mentioned in the comments there, your work is very well regarded internationally. We'll come on to the question of England maybe a little later. But, you know, recently, for example, on a trip to Portugal, I noticed that your reinterpretation of Vanya was being produced in Almada. And it's normal as you travel around the world to find Barker productions cropping up here and there. How do you account for your reception internationally?
Well, I could reverse that and say, how do you account for the fact that I'm not so celebrated in my own country, which I suppose is the same question in reverse, really. Well, I suspect most European theatre activists find these texts open to interpretation. Although they're very dense, as you all know, having worked on Wounds to the Face, they are open to a range of interpretations, and they don't carry a moral content, at least not a visible one. It's impossible to write a work without it having some kind of moral meaning, simply by virtue of it being a narrative. But it doesn't have an overt a message. For the English, that's a big problem. I can't speak for the Scots, but I always think of Scotland as a European country, and England is unfortunately not one. And the prejudice against my work in England, I think, is predicated on something that probably goes back to the Reformation, which is the idea of the utility of works of art. And these plays have no use. You know, we could ask these actors, you know, what is the use of playing this play socially? Not the use of it for an actor, it's a pleasure to play, I'm aware of that. But in terms of what it does to an audience, it doesn't have a very ostensible use value. You don't leave the theatre thinking, as Brecht would have liked you to have done, time to storm the police station. You know, it doesn't enable you to do that. In fact, it produces the opposite effect. It produces an effect of some sort of disengagement, I think, of confusion, of moral decay. That's a problem for the English. I don't think it's a problem for the French, Germans, Slovenes, and the other people who are kind enough to do my work. In fact, it fits very much into a European tradition. In Europe, what makes Europe the greatest culture in history is a conflict between the rational and the irrational that's not represented in any other culture in the world. The obvious examples are Hitler and Stalin, though, funnily enough, they meet in the middle in a funny sort of way. But if you go back to a European culture, particularly, say, writing, arguably the greatest novelist of the 20th century is Louis Ferdinand Céline, the French writer, who's an outright collaborator with the Nazis, a racist, and a right-winger without any hesitation, but an incredible writer, a brilliant writer. And you could put opposite him someone like Thomas Mann, a great humanist, wonderful narrative writer as well, with a huge kind of moral impetus. These elements are repeated over and over again in European culture. So where I am situated as within that spectrum is not a problem for European audiences. I think that's why it kind of goes down better there than,
yes. Yes.
than down south.
There's another question I want to ask you that's slight, in a sense related to that. You write in the 49 Asides for a Tragic Theatre that tragedy, and I quote, dares to be beautiful. And then you ask, who talks of beauty in the theatre anymore? They think it's to do with the costumes. So my question is, what's the source of beauty in a tragic theatre, and more particularly in the theatre of catastrophe?
Well, my starting point for that would be to say that pain itself is beautiful when it's represented dramatically. And tragedy is about pain. And it's about voyeurism to some extent. It's about watching the pain of a person or individuals on the stage. The moment you put an action on the stage, of course, it changes. It's not the same as an action on the street. The theatre of the 1950s, and it still happens at the Royal Court, it rather insists that the street and the theatre are the same thing. I would say they were never the same thing. The street is the street and the theatre is the theatre. Once you're in this room, not this room, but in a darkened room, it is not the street. Now, the effect of that is it completely alters your perceptions of an event. A murder committed on the stage, a passionate love act committed on the stage, is quite different from one committed in the street. And pain in that context acquires a certain beauty. It seems to me society requires pain. Civility requires pain. We must suffer. We do suffer individually, but collectively we must suffer. And tragedy makes that its business. It makes suffering its business. And it makes it beautiful. How does it do that? Well, that's a matter of staging to some extent. We've got directors here who will tell you about the staging of an act. But also, tragedy makes poetry its discourse. Tragic acting is not about naturalism. It's not like telly. It requires a skill, a highly developed skill, which the students here I know will get, a love of language. You know, if you want to play tragedy, you've got to love language. You've got to want to speak it, and speak it to people, and move them, and hypnotize them with the power of the poetry. So you're creating an experience which is essentially very beautiful, even though its subject matter is often frightful. Some critics call this kind of thing pessimism. I don't know why they call it pessimism. If there was ever a useless term in criticism, it's pessimism and optimism. They're redundant terms. It's not pessimistic to die. You just die. It's got many meanings, but it's not pessimistic. And tragedy knows that. And it brings death to you. It brings death to the audience and brings it into the life of the audience. And we cannot live without death. It conditions our whole existence. Which is why I argue that tragedy has never been out of date and never will be.
in a sense, you've begun to answer the question I wanted to ask you next, which was, you've often spoken of your admiration of a number of modern European poets, Rilke, Apollinaire, and so on. Do you feel that the art form to which theatre is closest, or at least the art form to which it should be closest, is poetry?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think... I think a good writer inevitably develops a voice. Though, of course, if you're a naturalistic writer, you don't need a voice. That's the conundrum of naturalism. In fact, you can't tell one naturalistic play from another.
Your work is treated by much of the English theatre establishment, but nonetheless, you have had as friends of your work many, many actors. Ian McDiarmid is an obvious example. In terms of Scottish theatre, Kenny Ireland, the actor and director who was a founder member of your own company, the Wrestling School. How do you account for that strong bond that seems to develop between actors and your work?
Well, actors like to speak. I suppose it's that simple. It's funny, sometimes when you audition young actors, some of them actually don't want to speak. It's funny, it's a funny experience. You ask a young actor to come in and maybe read a text which has maybe got 15 or 20 lines in it, and they don't really want to. And you sort of know that they're not the kind of actors you want to work with. They may be good at television, they may be good on film and so on, but others want to give you that text, especially if it's got a rhythm in it, which good writing has. They really want to deliver that text to the public, to you. And it becomes sort of erotic. The whole experience of a great performance is... Ian McDermott, you mentioned, is very good. Juliet Stevenson, another actress I've worked with a great deal, immaculate ability to lift meaning off the line immediately and to find the rhythm in that line. They react to it viscerally, sexually, even, I think. And there's a very good quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, who knew a great deal about drama, a great deal about drama, though he was not a dramatist, who said, and it should be written on the wall in a room like this, if you don't know the rhythm of a sentence, you don't know the meaning of it. And that's why an actor doesn't have to be an intellectual. An actor can play the most complex meanings within a speech without really actually knowing what the writer thought, what the writer's intentions were and all this stuff. It's not important. What is important is that they pick up the rhythm and deliver the rhythm, and then instinctively they know what they're saying. And you can always tell in rehearsal, I think, and directors here would agree, that you know someone's not, doesn't know what they're saying because they can't get the rhythm right. And you go, that sentence is wrong. That sentence is something is not in balance. And you ask them what they think they're saying, and then suddenly it's revealed. They didn't know what they were saying because they hadn't got the rhythm. The rhythm's critical. And this writing, it does that for them. It gives them a great experience in that way. And also the other thing, of course, it's constantly about confrontation. I mean, it's obviously in Wounds of the Face, people are always up against each other. They're at the extremes of their emotional life. And there's some ecstasy in playing, that sort of thing, I think.
Well, I'll ask an actor to speak
yes, I'm not for everybody.
In a moment, but I want to turn to Hugh, because needless to say, you are one of the prime movers in Scotland in terms of the admiration of which Howe's work is held, directing 11 of his plays with a number of generations now of actors at this academy. So how do you find that, and why do you continue to produce Howe's work in terms of the relationship between actors and the text?
I think the first thing is one of the great pleasures about going to a rehearsal room with one of Howard's texts with a group of actors is that I think especially with young actors, this is this wonderful thing, which is that none of us really know what the play's about when we start. And speak as a director, there's a great burden lifted there. And I think often directors unnecessarily carry this burden of being the fount of all knowledge and wisdom, and that they have to have the answers and so on and so forth. And I personally don't particularly believe that. Obviously, a director has to be taking a lead and with all the other collaborators, designers, and so forth, making a whole range of decisions about a production. But
But this, because Howard's plays are hard to know, hard to understand, and you don't really, you cannot begin to fully engage with them and understand them until they're being spoken, until the actors are interacting in the rehearsal room. They're a great pleasure to work on. Unlike just about anybody else. I mean, you know, there's an obvious comparison that you can make with Shakespeare, you know, in terms of poetry, rhythm, density of thought as well, and other exceptional writers. But they're very rare, those writers, those plays where you know you don't get it, and it prevents you from making easy assumptions about it, I think. And then in the rehearsal room itself, I think again, yes, the way I think I'd be interested to hear what Liam says, but a lot of the times, a lot of the way that we were working on it was very much that thing of, like with Shakespeare, if it doesn't sound right, you know that there's something missing. There's a level of engagement, a level of understanding that the actors still to find. So that was. That's always I find my way in working with the actors, and as it begins to sound right, as you begin to understand what's going on in the scene, the other remarkable thing you find over and over again is that the essence of what's going on is something that's very simple indeed, and this is almost an extraordinary paradox, because you start off with something that seems impenetrably complex, and then you discover that there's a very simple, visceral situation at the heart of it. And I think that, for directors and writers, is in itself a very exciting discovery.
Liam, you're in the interesting position of having performed in a Barker play directed by Hugh here at the Academy at Victory, and now co-directing one. What was your, trying to think back to your student days, what was your first impression of how it was written when you first acted it?
I remember thinking of it as a kind of fruit, big fat fruitcake. I just remember thinking I loved the kind of the sort of richness of it, and as a bit of there's something. I think the other main reason I fell in love with Victory is that there's just something for me that was great fun and beautiful and moving and everything about just the way you treat historical characters. I mean, it sounds very obvious, but to have Charles II, Effin and Cian all over the place, and I don't know, just the kind of robustiousness of it, I just loved. But I think, thinking back, we were all pretty scared at the beginning when we found it complicated, but I think one of the things I've really enjoyed is watching the cast over the last few weeks of Wounds to the Face kind of go through this process where somehow the language somehow working its way down to here, and that brilliant thing I think you said a minute ago about actors don't have to be intellectual about things. It's you know, at the beginning of the rehearsal period, you know, we discussed, we chatted everything else, but up to and including last night when I saw the show, and even just things people were saying, it doesn't seem to me to be that important. How eloquent you can describe it, but I was getting the sense off the cast of this kind of chuntering down to here of what you say. And thanks, people nodding, so it's making some kind of sense. Yeah, just something about it, and it's just been a joy to watch that blossom and to listen actually to those lines blossoming. And I think I understand, and I think I agree what you said about that idea of meaning being very linked with rhythm. There's a thing David Mamet says with Shy Love, which is, it doesn't matter how you say the lines, what matters is what you mean. And I think there's something about meaning and rhythm which is
just... I agree with him on that. I think where you say the lines are important, but you couldn't say the line right unless you got the meaning, you know what I mean? They're so intimately related, they can't be separate. There is a way of saying the line. You can always tell if someone's not good at it. Because in my lines, there's a rhythm. The rhythm's inescapable.
Yes, I must say, I think, you know, the task is just, okay, the precise sound of the voice will be different for each auditor, as it were, but our job is just to hear that voice and then recreate it as best we can, I think.
It's like music, isn't it? It is a sort of music. Maria. That's why the ensemble, when, you know, I really believe in ensembles. They don't exist much. There may be some in Scotland, hardly any in England. My company's sort of one of them. It's one of the ways you construct the ensemble is not just from good actors, but good actors whose voices act as an orchestra. You know what I mean? So you're just drawn to an actor or an actress because she or he has this tone or quality. So when they're all playing together, you get a real, really beautiful sonic effect.
I would add on that question of ensembles. I mean, from my perspective, one of the primary reasons that Howard's work isn't produced even more in Scotland than it is precisely because of the financial restrictions that disable the ensemble. We have very few. And if we had more, I think we would see how it's worked produced even more. It's been left to the RSAMD to a large degree to have the sheer number of actors required to perform most of Howard's plays. But I just wanted to ask you, Maria, because my feeling has long been that of modern playwrights, Howard is among the best male playwrights writing characters for women. Lorca is another. How do you find dealing with this character of the mother? Mm. Do you find this a rich character for you to wrestle with?
Well, the woman that I'm playing is certainly much older than I am. So I was, when I got the cast list, I was like, oh, all right, this is going to be a challenge. And it was. It still is. It's very hard. She's had experiences that I've never had. I have to look for this I have to look at this in a very different way than it's, every single performance I find more of her, and I don't think it would ever stop if the play went on and on and on. She's an interesting character. She's got so much to find.
Presumably you have to imagine both motherhood and a very profound sense of bereavement that comes through a son not being killed but being profoundly wounded. And it's a very difficult thing for a young actress to imagine herself into.
Yeah. To give my life for my son. Or the difference between, she has kind of two faces. She is a mother. She gives her life to, like, she loves another human being more than herself, but then also the lover. She finds this young woman in herself again, and the scene with the lover, where she's a completely different. I kind of find a completely different. I search for this in a completely different space in myself to find that it's completely two different, yeah. Then she moves away from this and becomes this mother who gives herself up for her beloved son. Yeah.
And Ed, you and the rest of the cast are presumably many of you coming to Howard's work for the first time. How does it compare with other work that you've performed?
Well, again, I think the obvious comparison again would be Shakespeare's, you know, what we're saying in terms of rhythm and lines and things. I think the complexity of it, for me anyway, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know I'm very guilty of when I approach texts, I keep adding things to it and just doing things that are just bad habits that I shouldn't do. And, you know, Liam and Hugh have drilled it into us, you know, just look at the text, look at the lines, keep going back to the words and always find meaning in the words. And I think that's the most important thing. And I mean, we're very lucky here. We do Chekhov in our first year. Certainly, we've done Chekhov, Shakespeare, and now we're doing Howard's work. So it's all epic in that respect. So, but very, very, very complex. I don't think I've wrestled. As I say, you know, you find yourself perhaps wrestling with the text so much, and it's. It's a challenge, but it's a pleasure to do as well. And I think, I mean, that's one thing we all can say as a cast. We're all, I think, relishing the opportunity and just loving every second that we have when we're on stage. And it's just, you know, it's just that joy that we're having. And I think that's one thing above any other play I've been involved in, any other text I've been working on, is that sort of pleasure.
in that sense, it kind of sounds as if you almost wish it could be going on for another week, that you would still be finding more in the text in 4 or 5 days' time. Before I introduce the audience to ask some questions, there are a couple of final questions I would like to ask to Howard. And one thing it seems to me, Howard, is that your writing, your plays, your writing about theatre, your speaking about theatre in forums like this, at all times, you seem extremely self-assured, and that sometimes you've observed that others may consider that to be an arrogance. I don't, but I do perceive a profound sense of self-assuredness. I suppose my question is, do you agree with that you're a particularly self-assured writer? And secondly, within that, does that assuredness come from a sense of having found your own artistic voice?
Well, I wrote my first play, and I had my first play performed when I was about 25 at the Royal Court. And it has to be said, I've had a pretty dire time in English theatre since 1971 or whenever it was. And if I hadn't developed some carapace in which to conceal myself, I'd probably have committed suicide. And I don't want to make self-dramatize, but you know, Mark, I've had a bad time in England. So you have to find a way of solving that problem. One of those was to write theory. You talk about my theory books. I mean, having been under sustained attack from the English establishment for a very long time, 15 years ago or so, I thought if no one else would speak on my behalf, I ought to do it, really, because you weren't around then. So my first book was a apologia pro vita sua, really. I was trying to defend what I was doing. And of course, I had to find a critical framework in which to justify instinct, because a good writer is first and foremost instinctive. You do it because you want to do it. You have to do it. And then afterwards you look for a way of describing what you've done. It's like if Wounds of the Face were a new play which had not been performed before, I couldn't have talked about it until I'd seen it. When I'd seen it, then I'd be able to talk about it. So, and having been able to write some sort of theory, I felt a bit protected from the hounding I was getting. But, you know, if I sound self-pitying, I'm not. That's how it goes. People have hard times. And some of the writers I most admire in the world have suffered vastly more persecution than I have. And as you pointed out, in other countries, things are a lot better. So, self-assurance is a way of protecting myself against the pain of some pretty awful kind of reviewing, really.
You've written plays for the radio, and you've spoken very warmly of radio drama as a neglected art form. I have to say, it's probably Radio 4's fault, but I personally have a prejudice against radio drama. But I'm interested in your liking for this genre, particularly as the body appears to me to play such an important part in your stage drama. So what's the basis of your attraction to radio drama?
Well, it's loyalty in one way, because BBC did my first plays, actually before, I had a couple on radio before I was staged. But then I'm not a very loyal person, so that probably isn't the key to that. I suppose, you know, what's nice about radio, and I know no one listens to it in a darkened room anymore, but that's how I used to listen to it as a kid with my parents, we turn the lights out. There is a sort of sense of the actors and the very few effects that are available, which are very primitive on radio, are obliged to create visuality from invisibility. And that's rather exciting, I think. And that still lingers. I recently, because it was my 60th birthday, the BBC did a play about on Radio 4 for once. Normally I'm consigned to Radio 3, which is the obscure bit. And I wrote a play about a 16th century humanist scholar who was secretly a murderer. And the moment we got into this tiny room, because radio studios are getting smaller all the time, technically you can do it in a bedroom now, which you couldn't do 15 years ago. The moment I sat there with Michael Pennington, who was playing this scholar, who was meant to be walking down a muddy road in eastern Poland in the rain, and he just walked in a tray of earth while speaking the lines with the text. It's primitive, and it's, again, it's rather sort of extraordinary. And it sounded wonderful when we heard it. So I'll always feel a certain affection for it. But yes, the body's important to me on stage, absolutely. It's quite true.
You were saying earlier, though, Howard, that the thing about radio, though, is it's done very quickly, isn't it?
You have to take it off. The actor has to get it right first time. There's no rehearsal in radio, frankly. You cast it correctly or you fail.
In a sense, the final question I was going to ask you has already been answered. I wanted to kind of keep the question of England to last, because it's very easy, certainly, for English journalists to present you as an oppositionist playwright. And I wanted to talk positively about your theatre rather than discuss it in the negative. But it seems to me quite clear that in Scotland your work is more widely and broadly supported than it is in England. And you only have to look at the work here at the Academy, and also recent productions at the Lyceum in Edinburgh, Dundee Rep, Strathclyde Theatre Group here in Glasgow, a semi-professional company, did a very good production of A Hard Heart a couple of years ago. And to the hilarity of myself, I have to say, and I'm sure to some other people, Pitlochry Festival Theatre, our most conservative theatre, arguably, has actually put the Castle on its shortlist for next year. Whether it actually makes the six that go on the programme is another matter, but very interesting to see even a theatre of the nature of Pitlochry Festival Theatre actually broaching the possibility of staging your work. So, in a sense, you've already partly answered it in terms of your belief that Scotland is more of a European nation. I mean, is that really what it comes down to?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a PhD to be written, or perhaps several, on why my work evidently cannot ever be staged on the National Theatre in England. You know, I mean, this is a place that's got huge resources, huge stages. I write big plays. If anyone should have plays in the National Theatre, it should be me, except, of course, for the key point, which is that ideologically I don't fit. Because I don't want to get into the big debate about National Theatres, because you've got your own arguments about that here as well. But it seems to me a National Theatre does speak the national ideology, or it wouldn't be a National Theatre. I mean, that's one of its defining characteristics, presumably. I mean, its remit is to produce the best work of its time. That's its remit, but in effect, it must carry the burden of contemporary thinking, or contemporary prejudice, perhaps one should say. And, you know, the National Theatre of England doesn't celebrate the Queen or the British Empire anymore, obviously. So what does it represent? It represents the consensus of a broadly liberal humanist society, one of whose pretensions is that it's critical, that it criticizes society, rather like the Guardian newspaper pretends to criticize society. So the writers they will employ will appear to be serving their kind of critical agenda. Now, when those are no wounds to the face and so on, it's not a critical play. I mean, the poor soldier comes home with half his face missing, but it's not a pacifist play. I'm not a pacifist. If it was a pacifist play, it probably would employ the National Theatre. You see the difference? You have to fit these criteria, as you do for the Arts Council, but that's another story, if you want funding. Well, there are criteria. In the National Theatre, they're hidden criteria, but they nevertheless exist. And if you don't match them, you probably won't be performed.
I'm not going to get into lobbying too publicly, but I do hope that it's not too long before we see the National Theatre of Scotland producing Howard's work. But that's a matter for the current directors of the NTS, but I know that it's been broached. So what I'm going to do now is invite members of the audience to raise their own points, their own questions to Howard and to the other people on the panel. So don't be shy in sticking up your hand.
Mark Holman, who directed Hard Heart, which I was just talking about a few years ago. We've heard a lot about the sonic aspects of the work and the musicality and the rhythm there's a strong visual component to your work, extremely shocking quite often, and wonderful. I wonder about challenges that face when directors see this on the page and all the resources that need to go into that, and whether you're thinking of those things when those challenges, when you're at the writing table, at your desk, or whether you trust designers and directors to solve those problems.
Yeah, that's the latter is the case. Yes, I think no writer for the stage should ever be deterred from figuring anything at all. If you want to put the Battle of Waterloo on the stage, you shouldn't hesitate to do it. Because even with a company of three actors, you can do the Battle of Waterloo. It's not difficult, actually, is it? well, it isn't. It really isn't. So I never deny myself anything. I never say that's a problem. Because I assume there's two people who will solve that, the designer and the director. They must solve it. Of course, sometimes they don't, and it's a mess. But you know, if they were good, they could solve it. So I never leave anything out of my mind, and that includes things rather less ambitious than the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, things, as you're implying, to do with the individual body, the shock of nakedness, which I find nakedness on the stage very shocking. I employ it, and it still shocks me, but I don't, to clarify that, I don't use it to shock people. I use it because it's necessary. But it has a shock value, and I understand that. And it would be a very sad day, I think, if nakedness was not shocking, if we got so used to it that it had no shock power.
And we've spoken before, haven't we, about the fact that there's an irony in the fact that our society appears to be pornographic and Puritan at the same time.
Yes.
And that therein, you know, leads to the outrage at both the physical nakedness in your theatre and to the use of language, particularly Anglo-Saxon.
To create an erotic situation which is purely erotic and therefore is dangerous, because eros is always dangerous, whereas pornography isn't.
There's a shock of violence as well. It leads to the face, which I saw yesterday afternoon. There's a man with half a face. Mm-hmm.